there's a culture war going on in this country, we can no longer remain silent on the issues that affect us all. Decisions we make now will determine our future. But how do we engage with the culture in a way that honors Jesus? How do we rise above the noise to know what is right and what is true? It's time to bring God back into the conversation. It's time to reconnect. Here's Carmen.
Welcome, friends. This is The Reconnect, where we're putting God in His place back where He belongs, right in the middle of every conversation. So how do we do that? How do we enter into conversations as ambassadors of Jesus Christ and speak His mind on the matters of the day? Let's face it, people don't need another piece of our mind. They need it, the very mind of Christ, and you are just the person to give it to them. We invite you to connect with us online at reconnectwithcarmen.com, like us on Facebook, and let us know what you're thinking about on Twitter using the hashtag CarmenTalk. My name is Birga Alden, and I'm filling in for Carmen this week. I am a former radio host, but currently serve as executive director of Love, Inc. of Albuquerque. Love, Inc. is a national organization with a mission to mobilize churches to work together across denominational lines, providing coordinated help to neighbors who are in need and giving practical help, both tangible and intangible. I invite you to learn more at loveinc.org. Now, I am very intrigued to speak with our first guest today because it just so happens that he is the co-author of the very first book that I was handed when I joined Love, Inc. A pastor from one of our partner churches handed me a copy of When Helping Hurts and asked for me to read it. Now, as Christians who want to make a difference in the lives of the hurting, we need to be aware that not all of our effort makes a positive impact. We need to be prayerful and strategic, learning how to help those who God has called us to serve. So joining us on the program is Dr. Brian Fickert. He is the co-author of When Helping Hurts, Alleviating the Poverty Without Hurting the Poor and Ourselves. He is a professor of economics and community development at Covenant College. He has his PhD from Yale University and the president of Chalmers Center, which can be found at chalmers.org, and also on Twitter at Fickert. Dr. Fickert, welcome to The Reconnect.
It's good to be with you today.
Well, I'm very excited to speak with you, and that was a sincere introduction. This was the first book that I was handed when I joined Love, Inc., and so I just find it funny how God works and allowing us an opportunity to talk face-to-face, in theory, today.
It's great to be with you. You know, the Chalmers Center has a partnership with Love, Inc., and so we're enjoying that partnership, want to continue to encourage your work. It's very important work.
Awesome. Well, I am delighted to get to have a platform to talk to you a little bit more in depth about this and to ask some questions, because obviously this is something that you and co-author Steve Corbett were really intentional about, seeing that, you know, we as believers have really good intentions of wanting to help the poor, help the needy all across the globe, but sometimes the best intentions have led to disastrous results. So talk a little bit about even the establishment of this book and why things got rolling for you all trying to share this message.
Yeah, you know, when the Chalmers Center began 20 years ago, we set ourselves out to be a church equipping organization, wanting to equip the church to help the poor. And, you know, in those days, it was really tough to find churches that wanted to work amongst the poor. Most churches were focused on evangelism and discipleship and preaching the word, all of which, of course, are extremely important. But then what happened is there's kind of a shift, and many evangelical churches started to say, you know what, we need to reach out as Jesus did amongst the poor and oppressed. And there's been a huge wave of that. We're so excited to see that. We don't want to diminish that in any way. Some people think the message of our book is that we should stop trying to help the poor because we might hurt them in the process of trying to help them. That's not our message at all. We want to see the church increase its involvement with the poor. You know, Isaiah 58 says that we should spend ourselves on behalf of the hungry and satisfy the needs of the oppressed. And we want to continue that movement. But we also noticed that a lot of churches and parachurch ministries were doing things that really were not very wise, that were actually creating dependencies, that were actually destroying the dignity of the poor. So we wanted to write a book that would say to the church, keep on going. Whatever you're doing, quadruple it, however much you're giving, multiply that manyfold, but perhaps do it a little bit differently than you have been in the recent past, because we actually think you're often doing harm.
Mm. So I want to make sure that I understand correctly. This book isn't a tool that you want us to necessarily hand over to the missions director of every church and say, read this because I think your missions project is all wrong, or is it?
Well, we don't want to say that it's all wrong. It depends on each church, but definitely we'd like to see both foreign missions folks and domestic outreach folks look at read the book and then kind of reevaluate what they're already doing. Sometimes it might mean shutting down a ministry or an approach. And in other cases, it might mean tweaking what they're already doing to kind of improve it. And so it kind of depends on the situation. Sometimes it's drastic overhaul. Sometimes it's just tweaking.
Mm. So there's going to be a big difference between assisting the impoverished in other nations versus on our own home turf, I would imagine. Talk a little bit about the difference between helping internationally and helping the poor here in America.
That's a great question. You know, certainly the economic environments are very different, right? So if we're in a place like Uganda, people are often living on, you know, less than $2 a day. And most Americans, even most poor Americans, are living well above that. And so there's quite an economic difference. But the underlying conditions are often very similar. You know, one of the big points of our book is that poverty isn't solely a material phenomenon. Rather, the material lack that we see in people is typically a symptom of something deeper, some underlying brokenness in people's foundational relationships with God, with themselves, with others, or with the rest of creation. So while it kind of bubbles up in an economic sense a little bit differently in Uganda than it does in Atlanta, some of the underlying conditions are actually very similar.
Hmm. So when we're talking about trying to help people that are stuck in poverty, what I'm hearing you say is it's not always just an issue of helping them get on their feet financially, but it's going deeper and looking at some of the other situations that have caused them to be in financial lack in the first place.
Exactly. One of the things we argue in our book is that we must diagnose the causes of poverty properly. You know, when you go to the doctor, the first thing the doctor does is try to diagnose what's wrong with you, and it's out of that diagnosis that the doctor treats you. And, of course, the doctor can make mistakes, right? The doctor could misdiagnose what's wrong with you, then give you the wrong treatment, and you might get worse instead of better. Or the doctor might treat symptoms rather than underlying causes. Imagine you go and you say you've got a headache, and the doctor says, you know, here, take 2 aspirin for your headache, but you actually get a brain tumor. You could die from having your symptoms treated rather than the underlying disease treated. And the same is true when we work with the poor. We've got to diagnose the problem of poverty correctly to provide the right treatment. You know, most North Americans, if you ask them what is poverty, they'll say it's something like this. It's a lack of clothing, a lack of food, a lack of housing. We tend to define poverty as a lack of some material thing, and hence we try to provide material things to people to solve the problem. But that's typically simply addressing symptoms. Think about what happens when you stop at a traffic light and there's a homeless person there. If you roll down your window and give the person a dollar, that's treating a symptom. You're not really getting at the root cause of the problem. I think that most of us know that. What we're really doing is enabling that person to be there again the following day. So what we argue in our book is we've got to get to the underlying issues, the broken relationships with God, self, others, and the rest of creation to really address the material issue, which is typically a symptom rather than the cause.
Mm. So I want to look at the other side of this then and talk a little bit about philanthropy. You know, we have the names in mind of predominant Americans who give millions of dollars, and we think, wow, what a great job they're doing. But maybe we've got a skewed perspective on what philanthropy really is and what it should be doing.
Well, we certainly don't want to discourage philanthropy. Again, our message is not that we should pull back our human resources or our financial resources, but rather we ought to think very carefully about how those human and financial resources are being spent. And so, you know, part of what we're arguing in our book is that because poverty is rooted in broken relationships, it's going to take a highly relational approach to restore the poor to what God has created them to be, his image bearers. And a relational approach is usually slow, and it's arduous, and it's full of stops and starts. A relational approach is highly people-intensive. And so a relational approach to poverty alleviation is actually far more expensive than the material approaches that we use. And so what we need are philanthropists to write very big checks to organizations that walk with the poor in highly relational and empowering ways. It's not cheaper. It's more expensive. The money just has to be spent differently.
Mm. If you're just joining us, we're talking with Dr. Brian Fickert here on The Reconnect. Brian is the president of the Chalmers Center and co-author of When Helping Hurts, Alleviating the Poverty Without Helping the Poor and Ourselves. All right, so I want to go back to that example you just gave of handing a buck or two out the car window to somebody who's panhandling. And then, you know, continue on with that train of thought that you were developing just then about how really getting to the root cause costs more money, not less. So how do we as the average American Christian deal with that? Because most of us don't have those deep pocketbooks where we can write a gigantic check to an organization and say, hey, go help that guy on Central in Maine.
That's a great question. You know, of course, the example of the homeless person often involves issues of mental illness. And oftentimes, you've really got to address those mental illness issues. But let's put that aside for a second and assume that the person is rational and is mentally coherent. What we really need are people to walk alongside of that person in ways that are empowering, in ways that ask the person what their gifts are. What kinds of gifts and abilities do they have? What kinds of networks do they have? What are their dreams and their goals? And how can we walk with them to use their gifts and their resources to achieve their dreams and their goals? And so it's really just befriending people and walking with them across time in ways that really helps restore them to image bearing. And so the first step is really just developing an empowering friendship. And it's a friendship based not on how can I fix you, how can I be the savior in your life, but rather a relationship based on God has made you in his image. You're a person with dignity and worth and capacity. Let's discover that image bearing in you and help that to flourish. And so it's a different posture. It's a different approach.
Mm. I want to have you address, if you would, please, those, and not necessarily those with mental illness, but let's just say we've got that same example of somebody on a street and they've got the cardboard sign up that says, willing to work. So I know that there is a strong correlation between employment and dignity. So how do we begin to, I guess, fold in these individuals in relationship and employment to help them get to a stable footing?
Well, that's a fantastic question. You know, work is inherent to image bearing. Work is inherent to the human condition. And when we work, we experience a bit more of what it means to bear the image of God. When we can't work, we typically end up being depressed. We typically end up lashing out at those around us. And so work is absolutely central. There are approaches to walking with people across time that helps them to become prepared for the workforce and to find jobs. There's a tremendous organization in Raleigh, North Carolina called Jobs for Life. The Chalmers Center also has a training process called our Work-Life Process. And so these are curricula and training processes that churches can use to really help people to get off of the streets or to get off of welfare and into the workforce. It's a tremendously important kind of ministry. You know, one of the things that Jobs for Life emphasizes so much is this idea of flipping the list. They've made a list of what do churches spend their money on in terms of helping the poor. At the top of the list are things like clothes closets and soup kitchens and benevolence funds. But way at the bottom of the list are things like job creation and job preparedness training. And so we need to flip the list. We need to reverse things so that the priority is actually job creation and helping people to enter into jobs and helping them to stay in those jobs once they get them. It's absolutely central to poverty alleviation.
Hmm. I know what's been my experience through Love, Inc. and just kind of walking through life as a believer and going to different churches over the years is it's a whole lot easier to write a check or to give a bag of donated clothing than it is to say, I'm going to walk alongside somebody that's in poverty and encourage them and help train them in a skill set. And is that a lot of what you're seeing, just the Christians want to give something easy and fast and they don't want to invest themselves?
Well, there's no question. For most of us, our most valuable possession is our time. And we are far more prone to write a check than we are to actually walk in highly relational and empowering ways. And so that's actually the primary constraint that the American church faces in being effective in its work amongst the poor. We're not lacking money. We're lacking people who have time, who are willing to sacrifice that time on behalf of those who are very needy amongst us. And until we get to that point where we're willing to actually sacrifice our time and open our homes, there are not really very good solutions to poverty right now.
I'm curious if you know, do believers in other countries, those that are living in poverty themselves, are they much more prone to invest their lives into others because they don't have the financial means to give?
Well, that's a phenomenal question. It's very interesting. The Chalmers Center equips churches both in the United States and around the world to empower people who are poor. Right now we are working in Togo, which is one of the poorest countries on the planet. And we have far more success in mobilizing churches in Togo than we do in mobilizing churches in the United States. We're able to help hundreds of thousands of people in Africa and only a handful of people in the United States. And the reason is partly because the gap in the U.S. church is often so big between the church members and people who are materially poor. But in a place like Togo, the church isn't ministering to the poor. The church is comprised of the poor. And so that lack of gap in the churches in Africa actually makes them better suited to ministering to the poor, both inside the church and outside of the church. And so we've got a problem. The American church is too far from the poor in most cases.
Boy, that's pretty eye-opening. On the phone with me right now, we are talking with Dr. Brian Fickert. He is the co-author of the book that's entitled When Helping Hurts, Alleviating the Poverty Without Hurting the Poor and Ourselves. So I want to bring it back around to the election of Donald Trump. He, of course, is a very wealthy businessman, business owner. A lot of his rhetoric has been around bringing jobs back to America. What do you think about his messaging, and what does this election mean to the poor of the world? And, I want you to take it away from there.
So the Chalmers Center focuses on equipping the church, and both the political right and left agree that the local church should do more to help the poor. And so the focus of the Chalmers Center is simply on the church. We're an apolitical organization. If you want me to wear a different hat, that is a professor of economics, which I'll do right now to answer your question. I'll just say this. I teach international trade. International trade is one of my fields, and the kinds of policies that Donald Trump is espousing, while they look good for America, I actually think are going to hurt America, and they're going to do real harm for people around the world. And so I think as Christians, we've got to have a higher allegiance to the kingdom and the church than we do to America first. And right now, the policies that he is talking about are very likely to do harm both to our country, but also to poor people around the world.
So I don't ever want to have, the end of an interview be kind of a doomsday prediction about what's going to happen. So let's talk some practical steps. Assuming that, we don't have the opportunity to get the ear of Donald Trump and, help him with some new policy directions, what do we as individual American Christians do to help our neighbors to be wise with both the time and the resources that God has given us?
That's a great question. It really comes down to, are we willing to spend ourselves on behalf of the hungry and to satisfy the needs of the oppressed, as Isaiah 58 calls us to? And what that really means is being willing to sacrifice our time, being willing to sacrifice our lifestyles, to actually immerse ourselves in the lives of people who are poor. One first step might be to look at the neighborhood around your church. Are there poor people in the neighborhood around your church? And if not, are there churches that are in poor communities that your church could partner with? How could you come alongside of those churches, not taking over their ministries, but supporting them in what they're already trying to do? I believe the Church of Jesus Christ is the good news of the gospel of the kingdom embodied. And that kingdom is a kingdom that has good news for the poor. And so the first place I would start by asking, what ministries does my church have? Can those ministries be made more empowering? If I'm not in a low-income community, can I partner with churches in low-income community in ways that are empowering to those churches and to poor with whom they're trying to minister? Our book on Helping Hurts has all kinds of examples of effective ministries and effective approaches that one can use.
So I want to have you address this real briefly, though, because let's say you are in a church that is in an impoverished community and you've got a bunch of houses around you with a bunch of weeds in the yard and it needs to be painted and roofs need to be repaired. If the church goes in and just does everything for these individuals, you know, a year or two later, you're going to see the houses in much the same condition you're going to see them in right now. So how do we work with the impoverished members of our community, helping them and not hurting them?
That's a fantastic question. You know, one of the things that we talk about in our book is this idea of avoiding paternalism. And paternalism can be defined as habitually doing things for people that they can do for themselves. And so I would never advocate running around and doing all kinds of things to fix up people's homes unless the folks in those homes are willing to participate in their own improvement. And so the first way forward is actually just to get to know our neighbors and develop relationships with them, look for ways just to hang out and be with them. It's amazing how much gets done if we will simply hang out with people, get to know them, don't try to fix them, just get to know them. And over time, start to ask kinds of questions like this. What are your dreams for your community? What would you like to see happen here? What can you do to improve your community? How can I as an individual, or how can my church walk alongside of you as you take steps to use your own gifts, your own resources to improve your own community? And so it's really a process of walking together. It's a process of doing things with people as opposed to doing things to people or for people.
Mm. Talking with me right now is Dr. Brian Eckert. He is the co-author of When Helping Hurts, Alleviating the Poverty Without Hurting the Poor and Ourselves. I would imagine we've got a number of individuals listening saying to themselves, man, I wish I had time to give, but I don't. I'm working 60 or 70 hours a week, but I do have finances I could give. So how do I find an organization that's helping and not hurting? How do people go about researching organizations to find out the best ways to give?
Well, that's a phenomenal question. I'm actually supposed to be writing a book about that right now. And so hopefully in a year I'll have a resource to help people with that. But basically, in When Helping Hurts, there are some key principles in there. For example, distinguishing between relief and rehabilitation and development. Not all poor people are in the same situation. Some need relief, which is a handout. Some need development, which is more appropriate when they're not completely incapacitated and can participate in their own improvement. So the first thing I would say is look for organizations that understand the difference between relief and rehab and development and are applying those concepts appropriately. The second principle in the book is focus on assets, not needs. If the organization solely focused on identifying the needs of poor people and then bringing in outside resources to meet those needs, or is it focused on identifying the assets and gifts of poor people and poor communities, of identifying those gifts, mobilizing those gifts, strengthening those gifts, or is it simply involved in addressing needs using outside resources? The third principle is the organization should be using participatory approaches, not blueprint approaches. What we mean by that is this. If we're trying to restore people as image bearers, that means that it's imperative that they be full participants in their own improvement. That means that they should have a say in what kinds of ministries are created, how those ministries are run, how those ministries are evaluated. As opposed to that, we have blueprint approaches which simply decide what poor people need and go and do it to them, kind of an approach. And so kind of looking at organizations through those three lenses is a helpful way to kind of to discern if the organization is actually walking well with the poor versus doing things to people or to poor people or for poor people in ways that can actually mar their self-image.
Hmm. Do you have resources on the website for the Chalmers Center that kind of helps narrow down the list for individuals that want to start this research process?
Yeah, there's some resources there. But again, if they will simply look at When Helping Hurts, there are chapters in there and some, I think, very helpful questions in there that can kind of guide people through this process.
Okay, fantastic. So again, the title of the book is When Helping Hurts, subtitled How to Alleviate Poverty Without Helping the Poor and Yourself, co-authored by Steve Corbett and Brian Fickert. So Dr. Fickert has been our guest today. Thank you so much for your time. It's been a pleasure to get to talk to you, and I certainly hope we get the opportunity to do so again in the future.
Thank you so much. It's great to be with you today.
And I'll point people over to your website, which is chalmers.org for the Chalmers Center. So thanks again. All right. Thank you so much for tuning in to The Reconnect. We really do appreciate your time and your attention today. And, of course, it is a brand new year, and we are excited to be sharing it with you. Visit reconnectwithcarmen.com for resources and more information. Stick around. More great interviews to come. I'm Birga Alden, and this is The Reconnect with Carmen LaBurge, where we're putting God in his place back where he belongs, right in the middle of every conversation. So we're talking about what people are talking about, equipping you to be an ambassador of the kingdom of God in the midst of the kingdoms of this world. We invite you to connect with us online at reconnectwithcarmen.com, like us on Facebook, and let us know what you're thinking about on Twitter using the hashtag CarmenTalk. So how do we share our faith in a time of confusion, lies, fake news, post-truth in this culture? How might we build bridges with unbelievers to help them come to knowledge and faith in Jesus Christ? Well, here with us is Greg Kokel. He has his master's in both apologetics and philosophy. He's spoken on over 70 university campuses. He's hosted his own radio talk show for 26 years called Christianity Worth Thinking About, serves as the founder and president of Stand to Reason, serves as adjunct professor of Christian apologetics at Biola University. He can be found on Twitter at Greg Kokel and online at thestoryofreality.com. Greg, welcome to The Reconnect, and I'm kind of intimidated to talk to you.
Oh, no, don't feel bad. It is great to be able to chat with you today. So I'm looking forward to our conversation.
I truly am as well. So there is a quote that's attributed to you that says, Christianity is a picture of reality. And I would love for you to start in with just explaining yourself on that a little bit.
Yeah, please. That's actually in the book. And it's a core concept in the story of reality. Christians, I think, often don't understand their own enterprise, okay? That is, if people ask them, well, what is Christianity? They're going to say, well, it's a belief system, and it's a relationship with God or with Jesus, and it's a way of living your life effectively, and all those things are true. But they don't go far enough, in my view, because these are oftentimes like pictures of Christianity from the inside, from the perspective of the convictions of the Christian, from his beliefs, his feelings, his relationship with God, etc. Jesus didn't see it that way, at least not initially. At first, he saw Christianity from the outside. That is, he saw the things that he taught as being true to the way the world actually is. And if it's not true to the way the world actually is, then all of these things that are happening on the inside just don't go anywhere. You know, Christianity doesn't ultimately do anything for you. It's just like Karl Marx has said, it's the opiate of the people. It's what makes you feel better, but it doesn't have anything to do with reality. I want Christians to understand that the core claim of the Bible and Jesus and Christianity are not just the theological details that we all know and talk about, but that these things are actually true in the deep sense of the word, that Christianity is an accounting or a view of the way the world actually is. It's meant, and my approach is meant to counteract the tendency of not only people in the world, but also Christians to relativize their own view. Oh, this is my truth, you have your truth, and they have their truth. Well, look at it. If our views are not accurate to reality, then they're no kind of truth at all, let's face it. They may be our delusion or our mistake or our error, but if they're not true, then they can't be any kind of truth, yours or mine. And so that's really the point there as we kind of launch out into the book, The Story of Reality. I want people to get cleared up on that confusion.
Hmm. This is something we've been dealing with at home, as I've got two teenage daughters, and they are inundated with just this worldview all around them that is just exactly contrary to everything that we try to teach them scripturally. And so they've got a view of the world that doesn't match up with the things that they're hearing at home.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a challenge from a parenting perspective, but even for the parents, it's a challenge, because the more you're engrossed in a culture, the more that it kind of shakes you a little bit if you don't have a solid foundation.
That's right. Yeah. Well, I have two daughters too. One's 12 and one's 9.
And I'm an old guy, you know, so, I mean, I understand the struggle. But it is not, here's a little insight on this, Carmen. It's not just that the views and the culture in general don't match up with what we teach at home. If what we're teaching at home is the story of reality, then the views of the people in the culture are not matching up with the way the world actually is. Mm-hmm. And we can actually employ that, and I talk about this quite a bit in the book. We can look at the way the world is and show that Christianity, the Christian story, has explanatory power. It's, as I told my daughters, I said, it's the best explanation for the way things are. Okay? So if you don't have God in the picture, and let's just say you're an atheist, okay, well, how are you going to make sense of the problem of evil? What is the problem of evil? Everybody knows there's something wrong with the world. Everybody knows that. Okay, how can there be something wrong with the world if there is no right way for the world to be in the first place? In order for there to be a right way about the world, there's got to be somebody who establishes what the right way looks like. You got to have God in the picture for there to be a way that's appropriate and right. And you can't have things not the way they're supposed to be unless that's the problem of evil, unless there's the way they're supposed to be. So notice how this gives us a little bit of a leverage now where reality is our ally. It's on our side, so we can show people how our story makes sense of the world that they actually experience.
Hmm. Sounds like your conversations with your 9 and 12-year-old are a lot more intense than mine with my teens.
Well, I struggle with the same thing everybody else does, and I certainly don't want to put myself up there. I feel like I don't have a clue most of the time, Carmen, but I just take these little opportunities, like I know you do, just to slip things in here and there, you know, when I can to kind of make my case, and we struggle along and pray a lot and do the best that we can. But, you know, I do want my girls to be thinking about these things. And fortunately, they go to a classical Christian school, so I got help in the school for our convictions. I'm not fighting the schools as many are doing in a public school system.
Yeah. One of the words from Oxford's 2016 list is post-truth. And we're hearing a lot about that. We're hearing about fake news. Talk a little bit to the audience, if you would please, about how we are to know what to believe and what we can trust.
Well, you know, it's a little frustrating for me to hear that kind of thing because let me try to put it in perspective. I think we are in a so-called post-truth, post-modern culture, but see, this is just window dressing. Every single human being is made in the image of God, and he lives in God's world. They've got to believe in truth. They do believe in truth. In other words, they do believe that there are things you can discover about the way the world actually is. And in fact, if you couldn't discover that, and I do talk about this in the book, if you don't discover that, you'd be dead in a day if you couldn't discover true things about the world. What this becomes, this post-truth culture, it becomes an attempt to dismiss the things that may be true that you don't like sexual issues or gender issues or do this, not that, whatever. Oh, I don't want to be under any rules. I don't want God messing with my agenda here. And so then we say, well, there is no truth. When we really deep down don't believe that, it just becomes a rhetorical trick to get out from underneath genuine moral obligations. So because I have that understanding, and I think it's an accurate understanding about the culture, I'm just keeping my ears open for when people start making statements about the world that really are statements they think are true, and they're moral and the like, and they have moral baggage to them or content, and then I could start asking them about that. Because I think most people actually believe on the foundational basis, the things that we believe. They believe the world was created for a purpose. They just don't call it Father God. They call it Mother Nature, you know. They would talk somebody out of a suicide if they could. Why? Well, they don't want to waste their lives. How can you waste a life that has no purpose? See, people already know this deep down inside because they're made in the image of God. They live in God's world. So when I encounter things like post-truth, okay, I know what's going on. It's kind of like reading the signs of the time. This is public relations. This is advertising. This is marketing. Even though people say it persuasively and with strong emotion, deep down inside, they don't believe it. And if we see this, this gives us a leg up. And then we can just pay attention and listen and start asking questions. And that will help people see that the things that they say they believe in rebellion to God, they don't really believe those things. Just when people raise the problem of evil, you know, doesn't that alone tells us something about the way the world is. Our worldview can explain that. Human beings are different. They're beautiful in a qualitative way, but they're also terribly broken. We are beautiful and broken. What's that all about? Well, our worldview, the story of reality, explains it. So once again, we're back to this point that Christianity thinks Christianity is true because it's the best explanation for the way things are. It has explanatory power.
If you're just tuning in, you're hearing from Greg Kokel, an apologetics professor and author of the new book, The Story of Reality, How the World Began, How It Ends, and Everything Important That Happens in Between. And you can find the book online at thestoryofreality.com. So if you would you address the trends in Bible literacy? I know that that's something that you have been aware of, and I'm guessing just from the outset that it's definitely declined over the years, but really the reality?
Yes, and this is something that I'm trying to address. You know, I have a little bit of angst whenever I go to speak on this issue, and I've been speaking on it over 10 years. And the angst is, this is so basic, this is so fundamental, it's so foundational, people are going to be bored in the audience. When I get done, I have people come up to me all the time, and they say, nobody has ever explained it to me like this. They haven't put it together in order like this so I can understand and get the big picture of Christianity. And this goes directly to your point, Carmen. This is Christians can sit in church their entire lives and never get the big picture. They get all these bits and pieces that are valuable, but unless they're connected together, we lose their significance. So think of it like a picture puzzle, all the bits and pieces that form the bigger picture. But for many Christians, the puzzle is like lying in pieces at their feet. It's a pile of pieces. And if they've never put their puzzle together, not only do they not get the big picture, and that's the biblical illiteracy, but they also don't know if they're missing important pieces, right? They may even have pieces from other worldview puzzles mixed in by accident. They don't even realize they don't belong. Some Christians actually believe in reincarnation, but the reincarnation doesn't work in the Christian worldview. It's like putting a carburetor on a computer. You know, it doesn't serve any purpose for us, and it's not a piece of our puzzle. But if they're biblically illiterate, they haven't gotten the big picture, which so many haven't, then they're just not going to be able to put life together properly. And this is why I think something like the story of reality, laying out the big picture and the foundational pieces, putting the puzzle together so you're never lost in the details again, is so important for Christians.
So it's easy to point fingers at the pastors and say, well, you guys should have been teaching us better. But ultimately, it comes down to the individual that we're not taking the time to study and get that literacy that we need. But it does leave you wondering a little bit, like, well, what is happening to the education of pastors, and why aren't these messages being spoken from the pulpits?
Yeah, boy, are you opening up a can of worms there, Carmen.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, it's, wow. I know a lot of pastors, you know, and all the ones I know are really good ones, but and they're trying to do a good job. They have a tremendously difficult situation. They have to meet a whole passel of needs, and only one of them is teaching their congregation. And some of them, I think, have been lured over into a kind of utilitarian approach. Okay, let me show you how practical the Bible is to your daily life. And so then they have all these topical studies about how your life can be improved by applying biblical principles. And that's just not the way the Bible was given. And the Bible was given in a different way. It is not a handbook for living happy life. It's about the story of redemption and the extension of God's kingdom in the world. And this is why, by the way, a lot of people think the story is about them. Hmm. It's not about them. It's about God. God's the first character of the story. It's all about Him. It's not about God's wonderful plan for our lives. It's about our lives for God's wonderful plan. You see, the tail often wags the dog. And so, you know, I'm sympathetic to pastors who get distracted sometimes and they've got to keep the numbers up or there's competition and stuff like that. They got so much to do. But I think your point about the it's not just the shepherd, it's the sheep have a responsibility as well. That's a really important point as well. And there are lots and lots of materials available to Christians. What I've tried to do is put together a work under 200 pages, easy to read, covering the foundational things in a very orthodox manner. It's classical Christianity. It's mere Christianity, if you will, but in a way that is understandable. I throw the ball so people can catch it. It's persuasive, I think. I have, as an apologist, I've mixed things in there that I call gentle apologetics to help people see that the common sense notions of life fit the common sense notions of our story. And so there's a sense of...
I'm going to have to cut you short. I'm so sorry, but I am going to point people over to your website, thestoryofreality.com. I think that's a great place to start. Greg Kokel, our guest today, thank you so much for your time. And I certainly hope people start there with The Story of Reality. Thanks again for joining us on The Reconnect.
So, friends, the op-ed page of the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal are two of my favorite daily reads. So let me ask you this, beyond the Bible and beyond maybe the front page of the paper, what and who are you reading and why? You see, if we're going to engage the culture, then we have to know what the people in the culture, and particularly the cultural influencers, are thinking. What are they saying? What are they teaching? Let me throw this name out there. Do you know the name Peter Singer? He is a philosopher. He is an author. He's a guy who's been around influencing culture for a long time. He teaches at Princeton University. And I would say that he is on the edge when it comes to ethics. So he is the person who, for at least a generation, has really been driving the ethical conversation. If you want to know how animals got the rights they have and how the animal rights movement ended up with the kind of intellectual foundation that it currently boasts, it's because of Peter Singer. So he is a person who is able to articulate ethical arguments and moral conversations in a way that, frankly, is very convincing. And so I think he's an important person to be up to date on. And he happens to have a new book out. And so I want to lift it up today so that you know what he's thinking about. And through him, what others among sort of the academic elites are thinking about in terms of moral decision making. So if you are a person who wants a robust test of your own ethical assumptions by which you live, there are genuinely few people better suited to be in conversation with than Peter Singer. Again, he is a moral philosopher, and he's a professor of bioethics at Princeton University. Some years ago, he ignited what is known as the Giving Pledge, and you may have heard of that by one of its great advocates, Melinda Gates. It's a campaign that encourages billionaires to actually give the majority of their fortunes to good causes. And 150 global billionaires have so far signed the Giving Pledge. So, Peter Singer is a person of influence, but in what direction is he influencing things? Well, here is one of the arguments that Peter Singer makes that I think is important for us as Christians to understand. First of all, he agrees with us that there can be objectively true answers to the questions of how people ought to act. But where he comes up with those answers is not from revelation, but from pure reason. So he does believe that we can reason our way to the right answer and the right action in every circumstance. His book, his newest book, is actually a book of dozens of essays that are put together. It's a collection of essays in which he seeks to address the pressing contemporary moral issues of our day. He addresses the issue of abortion, which, by the way, he argues that the interests of the conscious, rational being trumps those of the fetus, which only currently has the potential to become self-aware in the future. He addresses the issue of voluntary euthanasia, which, by the way, he favors. And he addresses the importance of each of us and all of us acting to prevent catastrophic climate change. There are 82 essays, so there are 82 different subject matter areas that he addresses. Now, each one of the essays is just 3 or 4 pages long, and so if you are looking for a way to engage in an intellectual conversation about moral decision making and the moral issues in front of us as not only people in this culture but global citizens, this is a great person for you to be reading. Now, let me just say, you as a Christian are likely going to disagree with him at many points. But I would argue this. You need to know why you disagree with him, and you need to be able to engage him at his level in a conversation, because he's training the next generation of elite thinkers in this country. Agree with him or not, I will tell you this. Mr. Singer practices what he preaches. He has not eaten meat for more than 40 years. And in 2012, he celebrated the European Union's ban on the use of battery cages for hens, which was a ban that he's been working on through protest beginning in the 1970s. This is a person who has made long-term commitments to the course that he is on. How many of us started protesting something in the 70s and are still actively engaged in whatever that issue is today? There is much that we can learn from Peter Singer, even if we end up disagreeing with him. So, back in November of 1971, he posted an article entitled Famine, Affluence, and Morality. This piece actually establishes during the emergency in East Bengal, it really establishes the conversation that you and I need to be having today about the global refugee crisis. So in 1971, Peter Singer really made the argument that you and I need to be paying attention to in terms of the moral obligation that we have in relationship to what we know about what's happening around the globe today, specifically in relationship to crises like Syria. All right, so I'm going to just remind us that in 1971, millions of people were starving to death. They lacked food and shelter and medical care, and the world largely did not respond. And individuals nor governments actually intervened in a substantial enough way to save the lives of millions of people. Well, you and I cannot claim to be unaware of what is happening. We can't claim to be unaware of what is happening anywhere in the world today. We are almost instantly aware of what is going on. And what Peter Singer articulates is this. He thinks we need a whole new way to look at moral issues. Our moral conceptual scheme is what he calls it. He believes it needs to be altered. And with it, we've got to alter the way of life that many have come to take for granted in our culture. Here's his question. If it's in your power to prevent something bad from happening without having to sacrifice anything of comparable moral importance, then ought we not morally do it? I think he's right. I think if you and I have the power to prevent something bad from happening, then and if by preventing it, we don't have to sacrifice anything of comparable moral importance, then we ought morally to do it. If you accept the principle that we should do the good that we can do, then you and Peter Singer at least have a starting point of conversation. He then introduces the principles of impartiality, universality, equality, and that leads to this conversation about doing the good that we ought to do from a moral point of view for folks no matter where they live. He basically says there's no possible justification for discriminating on geographical grounds. All right, friends, Peter Singer is a person who you should be reading. This is information that you should be engaging with. If we are going to be cultural influencers, then we have got to think at the level of cultural influencers, and we have got to engage with them in the kinds of conversations that they're having about the moral challenges that we face in our culture today.
Thanks, Carmen. Now, that is what you call a very full radio hour. That is all the time that we're going to have for today, but we want to thank you so much for listening to The Reconnect with Carmen LaBurge. I'm Birga Alden, filling in for Carmen this week, and of course, you can connect with Carmen online at reconnectwithcarmen.com. You can sign up for the podcast, donate to the ministry, and share today's show with somebody new. Have a great day, and God bless you.
Reconnect is brought to you by the Presbyterian Lay Committee. To continue the conversation and become part of the Reconnect community, visit reconnectwithcarmen.com.